Good morning. A story that simply will not go away is the ongoing issue with cervical screening for women in this country. This week saw the release of the Rapid Review of Cervical Check by Professor Breen McCraw. It showed that over 4,080 women had not been given the results of their smear tests as a result of IT problems and poor communication. Drive Time's Barry Lenehan spoke to Professor McCraw, and he spoke about how the lack of clear communication had frustrated the women involved, and in particular how the persistence of one woman, Sharon, had helped highlight the system's failings.
I met Sharon a number of times, I spoke with her multiple times, and I think I'm pleased that, and she fact-checked this chapter, that there's a significant chapter in the report called Sharon's Story, because not only was it right that it'd be there because she triggered this review essentially through her persistence and frustration, but also that it highlights many of the issues that caused me concern in a very real way in terms of, I suppose, poor communications with women throughout the process.
And from what you found, would any of this have come to light without Sharon?
Possibly not. I mean, I think there's ongoing evidence of women right across the country actually being frustrated and trying to get access to their information. And you will note that in my presentation earlier on, I talked about being really taken by the fact that quite a number of women seeking information about their smear test results through parliamentary questions. And I really questioned what sort of a situation we have when a woman has to go to those lengths to find out information about her own tests. And that's why one of my significant recommendations, I made 9, but the first two really were hugely significant for me. One was the Women First initiative within Cervical Check, whereby the emphasis would be on continuous flow of information to women, and that continuous communication and exploring the whole idea of sample tracking. Because these are automated electronic systems that a woman should be able to find out where her sample is at any given time, and that any information that can be given to women should be given to women.
Mary Wilson got the reaction of Lorraine Walsh, board member of the 221 Plus support group and member of the Cervical Check Steering Committee.
I feel like I'm starring in an episode of Groundhog Day, Mary. It seems to be, you know, the last year just repeating itself. Same messages coming through, women being left in the dark, not knowing what's happening, repeatedly asking for answers and repeatedly not being listened to. And, you know, obviously, Breen McCraw has done a very good job here, and, you know, he's brought a lot of issues to light. But I suppose we had thought when Gabriel Galley had done his report that these communication issues had been brought to the fore and that they were well underway and being resolved. And I suppose now, yet again today, we realise that, you know, we're not where we thought we would be. And I feel like a broken record saying this all the time. We're not where we should be. We're not where we thought we would be. We take a couple of steps forward and then even more steps backwards.
And Mary Wilson pointed out that it wasn't just a technical glitch or an IT failing.
But Lorraine, does it feel to you that it is always the women? Because when you delve into Breen McCraw's report, I mean, it's clear that it wasn't an oversight. They made a decision that they wouldn't do a manual communication with the women for fear that tests might get mixed up. But then they didn't communicate along the way, even that there was a delay. They made no communication. It wasn't an oversight. It was a decision.
Absolutely. And again, I suppose for us as patient representatives, we've taken a lot of time out of our lives over the last year, myself and Stephen Teep, to try and help put the patient's voice in there and you know, give an understanding of where people are coming from. But they're obviously still not listening to us, and they're still not listening to women. Like, when you think back and when you read there how many times that Sharon had to contact the Department of Health, and when you hear there also from Breen that there were actually 50 PQs submitted by women in Ireland just to try and get answers on their smear test.
These are the parliamentary, you know, questions, Breen McCraw saying, you know, having to go into the parliament to have questions put down to find out where's my smear.
Health. And it's simply unacceptable. And, you know, until we get to a stage that women are being listened to and they're not being treated, you know, differently, I don't know, it's so disappointing as a woman in Ireland that we have come so far in so many different ways and we're still not listening to the simple requests from women about their health.
Lorraine Walsh with Mary Wilson on Drive Time. And all of that was before it emerged that 400 women whose cervical smear test results had been delayed had received a letter with incorrect information about those results. On Tuesday, the death of Nobel laureate and author Toni Morrison was announced. From The Bluest Eye to Song of Solomon and Beloved, her writing had transformed American literature, creating space for a new way of reflecting life in America, particularly life for African Americans. Arena's Sean Rocks spoke to Bonnie Greer about the work of Toni Morrison and, in particular, her use of language.
I read in the New York Times today, they spoke about her prose ringing with the cadences of black oral tradition. How important is that aspect of her work, do you think?
Well, I suppose that's true. I mean, the cadences certainly is right, but other writers did that too. I mean, Baldwin could do that. Richard Wright could do that. Zora Neale Hurston could do that. What they didn't do was do the same thing, if I may say, that James Joyce did, in the fact that she put her people's imaginarium on paper, and she used it and to define the real life of them, so that she literally brought words into the language and thinking into the language that hadn't been there before.
You've spoken there, you've used that word imaginarium a couple of times now, and you've mentioned the African-American unconsciousness. You know, to what extent was she dealing, even though these people and these characters are quite often very real, and in some cases based on historical characters, was she dealing with a kind of a myth around characters rather than any kind of realism?
She was dealing with what we didn't say to the white man. So, in other words, she picked up the language, some of it not even spoken, that we spoke in our own heads and to each other. And she gave it agency by putting it inside of literature and making it literature, not even rendering it literature, because it was literature all along. But she took that unconsciousness and made it into literature.
And Sean asked about Morrison's prominence, both as an editor at Random House and her place in the literary canon.
She is the canon. And that's the thing, that's the most important thing to understand. She is the canon.
Bonnie Greer with Sean Rocks on Arena. Quiff, comb over, slick back, buzz cut, and yes, the beloved mullet. Men's hair, assuming you have some, has always had its own variation on the short back and sides. But in 2019, it's all gone Peaky Blinders. Here's James, age 10, courtesy of Brian O'Connell, as heard on Miriam.
I just got a line comb over and I was there.
You have a line, I can see just down the side of your head here.
Comb over,
so your hair is combed to one side.
And a star at the back of my head.
You have a star at the back. One sec, let me have a look at the back of your head here. I can see right at the back of the of your head is a star shaved into it.
Yeah.
And you know on the sides then, what blade do you use on the side of your head?
One, I think.
And is that blended in, is that what they call it, or fade, or what do they call it?
I think it's fade, yeah, fade. I just got it, because I liked it, I liked the style of it. I just see these people with stars and all that and lines and same thing as me, basically.
And the comb over, it's funny, if you go back years ago, maybe to your granddad's time, they would have all had, you probably look like your granddad did in the 1940s. What do you have to put in your hair in the morning now?
Gel or hairspray, and then use a brush to comb over my hair.
It's summertime now.
Yeah.
What happens in September when you arrive into school with a star in the back of your head?
They're not allowed in school, I'm going to.
Oh, so what'll you do?
I don't know.
You'd have to get rid of it,
just get the line and the comb over again.
Cute as a button. That was James with Brian O'Connell as heard on Miriam O'Callaghan. And hopefully that's softened you up just a little bit, because yes, it's Brexit time. Now, you know the way we're all holding our breath for Halloween? You might want to let that go, because this is like the horror franchise that just won't stop.
It doesn't end on the 31st of October. If we have no deal, we're going to have to talk. And the first things on the agenda are going to be citizens' rights, the financial settlement and the solutions to the Irish border before we even start to talk about a free trade agreement. If there is a deal, well, then we can start to talk about a free trade agreement and a new economic and security partnership. So this goes on and on and on for many, many years. This doesn't end. This is a permanent new status, a permanent change in the relationship between the EU and Ireland on the one hand and the UK on the other, and we're going to have to work through it.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, Minister for Finance and Public Expenditure and Reform, Pascal Donoghue, popped in with his abacus to his British counterpart, UK Chancellor of the Exchequer, Sajid Javid, and then spoke to Audrey Carville on Morning Ireland.
Is he absolutely committed to his government's policy of leaving by October the 31st, do or die?
He is absolutely committed to that objective. The Chancellor has made clear this on a number of occasions publicly. This is the second opportunity I've had to engage with him since he took office. He understandably reaffirmed the position of his government. I very clearly reaffirmed my position and that of the Irish government and the European Union regarding why the backstop is the best possible insurance policy for all of the risks that we may need to deal with in the future.
Did you feel the need to point out to him that he voted for it three times and was part of the cabinet which signed off on it?
In fairness to him, he is already aware of that. He explained why he had voted for us, but made the point now that there is a new prime minister and this is an agreement that while he voted for us, has now failed to go through the House of Commons on three occasions. I, on the other hand, explained why it's vital to North-South trade on our island, vital to the stability of the peace process, and explained very clearly the political and policy imperative of a backstop agreement being in place.
Minister Pascal, steady as she goes, Donoghue. And it's all over now for another week. Strings Attached on Bank Holiday Monday had musicians Zoe Conway and John McIntyre joining the RTE Concert Orchestra under the baton of David Brophy. Aoife Ní Cormac asked about marrying the worlds of classical and trad and whether the fiddle and the violin can ever really be friends.
How does it work, bringing the two forms together?
I don't really know. I know what I'm doing at any given time, but I mean, and probably for me, stuff I've learned from traditional musicians, I've taken into actually maybe classical music as well, you know, they kind of influence how I look at, you know, because classical music really doesn't exist. It's a construct, you know, like, because Mozart didn't write classical music, he just wrote music, you know, and we called it classical music later on. So it's not a real thing, actually, you know. And I think as the 21st century goes on, more and more musicians are not classical musicians, or fewer classical musicians who are dyed in the wool. They play all sorts of music nowadays, you know. And it's great. I think it's a really exciting time to be in music, no matter what your, you know, what area you learned in. Like, you know, I mean, certainly if you're a classical musician, you play music. I was always taught you played music by dead people for old people, which is terrible, you know. but you know, when you, and then you kind of get to learn different styles and work with different people. You know, it's kind of, there's a cross-fertilisation. We all learn from each other.
And what about Zoe Conway, who is both classically trained and a respected trad musician? How was it for her?
It was really difficult, actually, to be honest, as a teenager playing both styles, because in the traditional world you wouldn't really have any respect that you played classical music. I mean, that would have been totally terrible. And if I was entering, let's say, the Flat Ciol and they thought that I was wearing a shoulder rest, or, you know, had a very well-tuned violin or a very fancy-looking violin, you might not get placed in the competitions. And really it worked vice versa as well. In the classical competitions, you wouldn't let anyone know that you're playing traditional or going to sessions or anything like that. So it was actually very difficult at the time. It seems really bizarre now, because obviously the two worlds can work so easily together. It was a thrill, to be honest, to have the two different worlds, because, you know, one minute you're playing with a string quartet at a wedding and the next minute you're playing in a session at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Thank you. fantastic mix. That was Zoe Conway, John McIntyre and the RTE Concert Orchestra under the baton of David Brophy as part of Strings Attached, as heard on Bank Holiday Monday. Back after the break. Welcome back. It's a species for which we don't always have the most sympathy, but it's not easy being a politician. And in the cutthroat world of political campaigning, prospective TDs use every means at their disposal to catch your attention and your ear. On Colm O'Regan Wants a Word, political campaign songs were in focus, earworms that follow you into the voting booth and impel your pencil to tick that box, not this one, that one. Ditties just like this.
Come on now, folks, let's vote him in. Oh, make your vote and pray that he goes all the way. He's flat to the mat with his black cap and there's no time for tay. Or vote him one or vote him two, vote him anyway. Make the diff and vote him in, it's Michael Healy-Ray.
You were bopping along to that.
Bopping
page,
along, and, yeah. That's what a good campaign song does. It gets you bopping, but it's recognisable as well. Now, that's for me is an example of a good campaign song. Most of the good campaign songs, and I'm biased here because I'm a culture, most of them seem to be based on country and western songs, like the Healy Ray songs there.
And you have the candidate's name repeated in the chorus.
Repeat the candidate's name. Get a few references to Tay, something that will rhyme with Healy Ray. References to Tay, brilliant, genius. 100% from me.
So that's a numero uno for Adrian Kavanagh, electoral geographer at Maynooth University. But boy, oh boy, was he not a fan of this song from Martin Lonergan in Clonmel.
Come young voters, one and all, text the fathers and the mothers to vote for Martin Lonergan. He's a cut above the others. Text the uncles and the aunts, text the sisters and the brothers. And when you've finished texting them, don't forget to text the others. Vote for Martin Lonergan, running in the local election. To vote for Martin Lonergan when making your selection.
No.
What's wrong? Well, what's possibly wrong with that? I felt it had tones of Icelandic wistfulness and everything going on there.
It is, yeah. You do get that Icelandic feel, but that's not what you want from a campaign song. You want to be hitting the knee. You want a bit of oomph, not...
You want to be hunting cattle around.
You don't want to be thinking about Bjork and Icelandic surrealism. You want to think about being out the country, you know, having the tea, etc.
You're quite passionate about this. Like I'd thrown it out as a kind of a glib afterthought into the show, but I think we should build the whole thing around this, to be honest.
From Colm O'Regan Wants a Word. Thankfully, it is August, which some deride as the silly season on the wireless, but often, as the political temperature drops and the empty spats abate, it allows quieter voices and more nuanced stories to come to the fore. On Sunday Miscellany, Vincent Woods gave us a short poem that said so much about longing and escape.
What a young Fermanagh woman said as she toiled with praties and fire. One day I'll walk out of here, and I'll walk and I'll walk until I find a ship to America, and when I land there I'll set out again and keep on walking till I meet a man who has never heard of Boxty. And I'll marry him.
A little flavour of Sunday Miscellany. The documentary on One this week was called I Hope You Will Be Home Soon, from Nicola Carr. It was a gentle, meditative documentary about a family on a farm and how six children coped when their mother went to Piemont Sanatorium when she had tuberculosis. The basis of the documentary was a box of letters that the children aged 6 months to 15 years had written to their mother, detailing their lives and the changes on the farm and taking care of the baby, Catherine.
Monday, Clannad, dear Mammy. Sheila has only 3 goslings out of 18. Hard luck for her. 2, Mick is going on great and might be going to work on Tuesday. Mrs. Dunn is in bed, sick. She has a septic flu. As the nurse says, they are all very good to her with bottles of whiskey, lemonade.
No wonder she's dead in bed.
Dick sends all his love, and John too. He wed the Carrots this evening. It's a great job. My birthday is very soon. Will you be home for it? Mrs. Dunn gave me a lovely summer skirt. It is a bit too big. The heifer milk's great, and we have plenty of milk now. Anyway, the cows stay out in the pasture all night. Catherine has 9 big teeth. I give her an egg in a cup every morning. The pigs are got terribly big. Now they are able to eat enough now, anyway. Myself and Granny did the washing today. There are some pansies out in your garden. The lilac is in bloom everywhere. Catherine is able to say Mary now and able to say Day-Day. The meadows are very high now, and the corn. The jackdaws have little ones in our room chimney. Granny washed my hair last Wednesday. I will say goodbye now. Your loving daughter, Philomena. Do you know what I notice about all the letters? And it's really sad. First of all, we talk about the daffodils and the flowers in the spring, and then we talk about the meadows, and we talk about all the fowl getting bigger, and we talk about the corn, and we talk about the pansies in the garden. So it's summertime and Mam is still gone. You know, that's really sad.
From the documentary, I Hope You Will Be Home Soon. Letter writing also cropped up on the Marion Finucane show. Her guest at the weekend was Eilish O'Carroll, who'd gone into the archives and brought us this gem.
Dear Frankie, my boyfriend, he insists that we go Dutch. His argument is that in this day and age, it would be offensive for a man to pay the girl's share, since it would imply superiority in him, and also a sort of menial status in the girl. Yours sincerely. I'm sure it goes down splendidly at intellectual gatherings, especially if there are a lot of women present. But where personal relationships are concerned, I think there's something about the fact that a man pays for a girl's cinema ticket, which brings out the best in a man. It gives him a pleasant preview of the joys of providing. And later on he'll find out that it's not so easy. Equality of sexes may be fine, but until the girl finds it easy to propose marriage to a man without the excuse of leap year, don't rely on it too heavily.
It's amazing. I mean, it's laughable.
But in the O'Carroll household, Dear Frankie was used as a teaching tool, an example of how not to treat the women in your life.
My mother would have probably been hitting her head against the wall, but she would have actually found it extremely funny. The boys, however, because I had 5 brothers, and and at that time, all my sisters had emigrated, so I had 5 brothers, and they're, you know, if they were there in the house and this discussion would take place, they were, you know, oh no, they're very macho, you know, and I mean, no, this is the way it should be, and a woman should do as she's told, and she should realise how
Did
lucky
Brendan
she is.
Did Brendan O'Carroll say that
no,
to his
I think
sister.
Brendan was a little bit too young, right? Right, and if he'd have said that in front of my mother, it was, you know, he'd been put to bed, but there was some very positive stuff that came out of that from our perspective, because we had some very healthy debates.
Eilish O'Carroll with Marion Finucane at the weekend. And although the pen and paper might be pretty rare these days, affairs of the heart are timeless, and there's no escaping love or heartbreak. Maggie Doyle received an email from a woman whose husband was having an affair.
Hi Maggie, I'm just sitting here in sadness. I'm writing this because I'm too proud to tell anyone about it. 10 years ago, I met the man of my dreams. Every day, he told me how great I was and how much he loved me. We went on to have 2 beautiful children. 2 years ago, I felt there was something wrong. I had a feeling he was having an affair as he started to be out a lot more. I set a trap and he fell into it. My suspicions were right. He was cheating on me. He begged for forgiveness and I gave in. This is now, I believe, the worst decision I ever made. I gave birth to a new baby earlier this year, our 3rd child. I thought everything was great, we were happy, and I believed we were back in love. Well, the worst has happened. I have discovered he's been unfaithful again, but this time it's worse. I think he's sleeping with escorts. I'm devastated. What can I do? Should I confront him now or wait until I'm a bit stronger, as I feel I am very vulnerable at the moment with a new baby? I am just heartbroken and confused. Please keep my name and details confidential for obvious reasons.
Well, as you might imagine, people had advice to offer to Sensworth, much of which you might expect.
Hi, Maggie. I forgave my husband his affairs. We had three young children at the time. 7 years later, I discovered he was having another affair. I wasted 15 years of my life with a cheat. We eventually split. It was tough and scary, but I regret not splitting earlier. A leopard never changes his spots, and she will never be able to trust him again.
Fair enough. But then a woman rang in, Miriam, and she had an alternative viewpoint and her own story.
Sometimes I think that sex is taken too seriously in a marriage. I don't think that women always understand the male psyche enough. Now, I may be a bit too soft on men, but this has just persisted with me all my life, and I've had so many different experiences vis-a-vis men. And I have never really changed my opinion that sex is just an intrinsic necessity to men and that they have a very different view to women on it. You know, yes, he did have an affair. It happened to me. It's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. But she has to weigh up the value of her relationship with this man. He was found out. They did talk about it. He has changed. This time it's escorts. That is not the same as a relationship with a woman. It makes it more separate.
Well, I mean, I don't think that she feels that. I mean, she feels it's even worse in a way, I think. But she's also saying that, look, it's happened and it's happening again. Tell me, did you forgive Miriam when it happened to you?
With great difficulty, I did.
But was it hurtful to you at the time?
It was extremely hurtful, and I gave him hell, you know what I mean? He didn't change his ways.
Okay. Well, listen, Marion, you make an interesting point, I suppose, not one that we some people have thought of here, but this other person does.
Perhaps somewhat unusual advice, but from a woman who's been there. And swivelling back briefly to Marion Finucan, she's Flavour of the Month over on Pantisocracy.
Oh, I'm known as, in London, they call me Marion Finucan.
Yeah.
Because I was in Barcelona last June and I was doing Marion Finucan. I was explaining to my Irish friends what the hell was happening in Ireland. I'm kind of obsessed with everything that's happening.
Well, you know, most of the rest of the world does not wake up to the kind of radio that we wake up to.
Oh, it's, there's a, like,
they're just the way they speak. You know, and it's fun.
I do exactly the same. Like, when I get up in the morning, I can listen back to Sean O'Rourke straight away.
I love Sean.
And then, you know, on Saturday, because that's what I do every Saturday in Ireland. So I kind of recreate that in my apartment. I kind of have late breakfast.
Oh, my God, Marion Finucan is home.
That's bizarre.
We've cracked it.
We've got her here. She's coming in.
She's it.
Radio has just eaten itself. Back after this. Welcome back. On Pantisocracy, the theme this week was the emigrant experience and the relationship with Ireland. Panty herself had been an emigrant, a very happy one who lived in Japan. But being Irish was bred in the bone.
You can leave it, but it never leaves you, even if it pushed you out in the first place. It leaves a kind of brackish, stubborn stain that's almost impossible to remove entirely. You know, a biological mark that's developed resistance to potions, both bio and non-bio. You can paint over it, you know, shiny new Dulux skin, you know, but eggshell, matte or gloss, it bleeds through your carefully chosen elephant's breath.
And guest Irla O'Linard spoke about living abroad and performing Irish.
To be even understood sometimes in these places is an incomplete sort of phenomenon.
Yeah.
I find a tendency in myself to play up my Irishness, which I try to dampen, because I can be the funny guy, you know what I mean? Yeah.
But you're also a Shamrock singer. I mean, like,
yeah,
you know.
But they don't know what that is for the most part. I mean, you know, Shannos didn't even exist as a word internationally until very recently, if it does now. But, like, I often find sometimes, like, the Irish guy, you know. One of the first times I went to Princeton, I met a composer, and he said, hey, you're the Irish guy, because he'd met me before. But I tend not to worry about those things anymore. I mean, I like to talk about people, about the things that they want to talk about.
Yeah.
The things that we have in common, which is music making for the most part. There's not a whole lot of discussion about politics or even identity in that sense. There is a fascination with Ireland, however, which I find the Americans have, even though you'll meet mostly people who aren't of Irish extraction, they still seem to... They know more about Ireland than we deserve.
Well,
Irla O'Linard on Pantisocracy. But the experience of being Irish abroad was echoed in material heard on Bowman on Sunday, which was excavating the life and times of Brendan Behan. and perhaps expose the cost to Behan of living up to the image he had cultivated or had foisted upon him.
I think that, of course, there was a certain side to him that was an actor, was there not?
Fellow writer Colin McKinnis, who knew him in his London years.
One rather senses that, for example, to mention Byron once again, that he was a bit of a performer, wasn't he? So was Pushkin, a bit of a performer. Balzac, one senses, was also a bit of a performer, right? And in that sense, I think that Brendan was that, and quite legitimately, and that he enjoyed doing it.
And the English public.
His biographer, Ulick O'Connor.
The English speaking public wanted to find in Brendan a two-fisted Irishman who would shake his fist at the establishment.
But I think that is very far from being the entire Brendan. I wouldn't say it's not the real Brendan, of course, because it was a part of him, but I think it's very much from being the entire man.
Well, it seems to me that you've gone down to the corner once too often, and to put it mildly, Brendan, you don't appear at your best on television when you've got one over the eight. Does this not make you feel embarrassed, being a shy person, that people should see you like that?
I'm embarrassed being dead at all. I'm embarrassed now and I haven't won over the eight. I haven't even won over the seven.
The voice of Brendan Behan as heard on Bowman on Sunday. On Thursday, Maggie Doyle spoke to Jesse Ricks and Anthony Butler, who had met as running partners. Anthony talked about his upbringing in the Bronx.
My mother left my father, and my father was going through, like, depression, and, like, he lost his job, and they really wouldn't provide for me. Like, so I remember, like, my eighth grade graduation, my father was a manager of McDonald's, and I asked him, like, what's my graduation present? And he gave me a uniform. It was like, you're going to work the next day. So back then, I was getting, what, $5.15 an hour, but I was only working, like, 14 hours on the weekend. So that's, like $75, $60 a paycheck. So that wasn't enough for me. So I know some dudes who sold weed, like, right across the street from McDonald's, and I'll take my paycheck, and I'll go get some weed, and I'll just try to flip my paycheck every week. And that's how I started when I was, like, 13, 14 years old.
It's a dangerous job selling drugs because of all the other kind of guys and the chain that goes up higher, I guess. So
oh, yeah,
were you worried, you know, were you kind of worried for your safety at all? Or
Yeah, but I mean, sometimes you just, the thrill of it is also exciting too, right? I mean, you're getting money every day and you're just hanging out with your friends, and sometimes the risk is what's most gratifying about it, you know, so.
However, on September the 8th, 2008, he and a friend got into an argument and a gun was pulled.
Dude pulled out and I got hit twice. One of my other friends got hit in the arm.
He pulled out a gun.
Pulled out a gun. Yeah, yeah. He shot me twice. I got shot in both my legs and in my head. And my other friend got shot in the arm. And he tried to shoot my other friend, but he missed. And then they ran off. And I remember just looking around. I blinked once, and it was good. And I blinked again, and I couldn't see anyone. And it was over. Yeah.
Anthony lost his sight completely at the age of 20. But he said that in some ways, this life-changing event had helped him turn his life around, although recovery was not easy.
My first walking lesson, they teach you how to get around, and she was like, I'm going to teach you how to walk around the block. And it was probably like December or January, and it was hailing outside. It was hailing, it was raining, it was probably 20 degrees. And she's just like, all right, let's go do this walking lesson. And I'm like, but it's raining, like, we can't go outside. And she's like, well, that's life, like, it's not going to stop raining for you. And I remember just walking around that block with the cane, and I was crying, like, hysterically bawling, you know what I mean? And she's just like, you got to do it. And it took me an hour to walk, like, one city block, you know? And then I was just like, it's not going to get any worse than that, you know? It's only go up from there.
And then he met Jesse from Minnesota, who was a fellow runner, and they became running partners.
When you're blind, it's hard to meet people, you know what I mean? So I take every opportunity to talk. I'm a very social person, you know what I mean?
Well, why not? And so how often did you meet up to run then? Was it a weekly or did you kind of...
It was weekly. We meet twice in New York, twice a week. So it's Tuesdays and Saturdays, Saturday mornings and Tuesday evenings. So, but shortly after, I was like, oh, I like to meet... I signed up for so many races that I need more than like one guide or more than 2 days a week to train. Mm. So I got a phone number. It was like, let's meet up other days during the week so we could, like...
I see what you're doing there, Anthony. Yeah, yeah. Again, you're just trying to spend more time with her.
Yeah, listen, yeah.
And just how did Jesse feel about all this?
How our friendship transitioned into our dating relationship is just, you know, once my relationship that I was going through and the hardships of that ended, Anthony was... like my friend that I spent so much time with already. I mean, we spent so much time running together that it's like you talk about everything, the good, the bad, the ugly. So it's like, it was, you know, he was that person that was just, he was there.
And now, dear listener, they are partners in running and in life. And Anthony gave us all some life advice via food.
You know, encourage people to say yes, you know, stepping out of their comfort zone, whether it's going to church or just doing something. Like, you have to put yourself out there so you can meet people who share a common interest with you. Don't be afraid to do something that you've never done before. Like, my rule in life is try everything one time a year. And if you don't like it, don't do it again for another year. So I started eating eggs that way, tomatoes, just little things like that, you know. But
That's a good rule.
Yeah, opened up my life so much more, you know. So just...
I'm going to try mushrooms, Anthony.
There you go.
I really don't like them.
Magic ones.
I don't think so.
Maggie Doyle talking to Jesse Ricks and Anthony Butler on Thursday. Catherine Thomas did a little trawl for embarrassing stories and gamely got the ball rolling with her own red-faced tale.
It was a few years ago. I was at the Film and Television Awards and I was going on stage to present an award, and I was waiting for my turn. So I was in the green room and I was getting my makeup touched up, you know, with a bit of powder on, and I was chatting to a few people and having a drink of water. There was a toilet off the side of the green room and it was a wheelchair access toilet. So when I opened the door, the actual toilet itself was about 3 metres from the door, you know, to allow access in. Anyway, the lock was broken, but there was a security guard standing at the door, so I presumed that he was there because the lock was broken. So thought nothing of it, went, sat in the loo, and I'm sitting there talking to myself. I'm looking at myself in the mirror over the sink, and I'm chatting away and I'm going, "I'm the nominees for best factual, whatever." And the next thing, the door bursts open. And when I say burst open, standing there, and I'm too far away from the door to do anything, and I'm perched up on the toilet, Pierce Brosnan looking at me. And I just looked at him and he looked at me, and he looked a little too long, and it was about 3 seconds, which felt like 3 minutes. And he just said, "Oh, sorry," and closed the door again. And I just looked back at myself in the mirror and going, James Bond has just seen me on the jacks.
Oh, Catherine, I think it's the lingering look that's the killer on that one. Well, on Liveline, 17-year-old Alex had been expelled from Colossia Lurgan for climbing out a window in the middle of the night. His mother Barbara accepted what he had done was wrong and he'd broken the rules, but took issue with manager Michal for the procedure and manner of Alex's expulsion. And it's fair to say that things got heated.
He was told, "Dún the veil, ní húla mé, sí
siad." No, "Dún the veil."
"Dún the veil," he was told. This was by your deputy principal. He tried to explain. He was told, "Dún the veil." The principal was standing with him. He was in the office. He had the door half open. "Dún the veil, ní húla mé, sí siad." For anyone who doesn't understand that, that's shut your mouth, sit down. I'm not listening to you. Sit down. Now, for any principal, deputy principal, teacher, role model to speak to students in that manner, that is an absolute disgrace. And these are private students that we're paying for, and you think that that's okay. Now, where in any of this have I trivialised this misbehaviour? I have not trivialised this in any way, shape or form, and Alex knows that.
Climbing out windows.
I requested documents from you that you didn't furnish. I requested the appeals process that you don't engage in, that you're supposed to engage in. Excuse me, let me speak. I let you speak, you've had plenty of time.
Okay,
I requested border management members' name. I requested your GDPR information about children there and the ones who are there and have been there previously, because your deputy principal breached the rules and spoke to me
about those students. I understand, so I'm not trivialising.
And your answer to me was that I was trivialising the misbehaviour, which I wasn't, that I am juvenile and irresponsible, which is completely wrong. I'm being extremely responsible by asking you for the documents that you should be providing me with. You're the one being irresponsible by not providing them.
Well, Joe intervened to get a response.
Michal, is there an appeals procedure?
For an appeals procedure, I understand she has engaged with Rian Lagaille, what we would do, I suppose, we would discuss it here, and we do stand over it. We would stand over taking a decision in relation to leaving Isachloshtin in the middle of the night. being a kind
so
of
the specific process on the website, they say that before they expel a student, there's a specific process engaged in, right? So they're supposed to, because with the rules, they're supposed to engage in, they're supposed to give the children or the students an opportunity to speak in English or Irish. So my son wasn't given, afforded any chance to speak at all, regardless whether it was English or Irish.
I asked
for the report on the specific process that you engaged in, and I was told to stop trivialising this and stop being so juvenile and irresponsible. I gave you a written email of all the points I was appealing.
You did phone ten times in one day, Wiseby. No, I didn't.
Yes, you did. No, you didn't. Yes, I did. Well, then the phones started hopping. Here's Orla.
Point is, I'm actually surprised at this mother. I'm actually surprised Barbara's been given airtime. I have had, I'm the mother of three teenagers, all of whom have been to the Gaeltacht. My daughter was actually in Lurgan, fantastic college, was really well run. But when you go out to the induction meeting that everybody must go to and must attend, the rules and regulations are very clear, Joe. These are the rules. This is what we have to do. If you have 500 or 600 kids, you cannot allow everyone to run riot. If something had happened to him while he was out of the house, Barbara, you would have been the first one out of the collage to say,
I'm not disputing that he left the house and that it was a serious misdemeanour. I'm disputing that there is absolutely no appeals process available.
They are governed by
rules laid down by the Department of Education and Skills and the Department of the Gaeltacht. And let me correct you on that one. This is his third year down there, and I've never gone to an induction course. It's not compulsory.
Well, maybe you should have.
Orla, Barbara, Micheál, and of course, Buchaldona Alex. That was Liveline on Fire. And of course, there's nothing more annoying in this world than to be told to calm down when you're that head up. But I think we're going to take our cue from Tay Tay.
You are somebody that I don't know, but you're taking shots at me like it's Patron, and I'm just like, damn, it's 7 a.m. Say it in the street, that's a knockout, but you say it in a tweet, that's a cop-out, and I'm just like, hey, okay. And I ain't trying to mess with your self-expression, but I've learned a lesson that stressing and obsessing about somebody else is no fun. And snakes and stones never broke my bones, so
words of wisdom from Tay Tay. And that is it from Playback for this week. Thank you for listening. Chat to you next week, and go Mayo.